It's Monday, October 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump says the election is rigged against him.
It's raised questions of whether there's some kind of negotiations going on, and what that could be, we don't know, but it's not a good sign.
Thailand mourns the loss of its king amid successorship uncertainty. Also ahead, the BRICS economies vow to strengthen their bonds, tennis in China, and what it feels like to live in a Syrian refugee camp. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump conceded Sunday he is losing support among female voters. But he blamed it on media accounts of women that he says have falsely accused him of making unwanted advances on them.
The election is being rigged by corrupt media pushing false allegations and outright lies in an effort to elect Hillary Clinton president. But we are going to stop it. We are not going to back down.
Trump says on his Twitter account that national surveys show his campaign against Democrat Hillary Clinton remains close, but he says he has lost large numbers of women voters based on made-up events that, quote, never happened, media rigging election, unquote. However, Trump's ticket mate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, said he and Trump will accept the outcome of the election. A national average of polls compiled by Real Clear Politics shows that Clinton with a 5.5 percentage point lead. Two major polls were released Sunday, with the Washington Post ABC News survey showing her advantage at 47% to 43% among likely voters, while NBC News and the Wall Street Journal said their polling shows Clinton with a bigger edge, 48% to 37%. VOA's Michael Bowman joins me in the studio to discuss Trump's treading into uncharted waters for U.S. politics.
Jim, we are still 3 weeks away from voting day in the United States, but already Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump is sounding the alarm that he believes that there is some monkey business going on, that there is a campaign against him, that the election is rigged, that the election will be stolen. No one really knows exactly what he might say on election night if, in fact, he loses. But this does open up the possibility that one of the great traditions of American politics might fall by the wayside this year, which is the concession speech. Every losing presidential candidate comes out and says, I accept the results. I have called up my opponent. I have spoken. I have congratulated him. And I'm ready to move along. And I hope that the country will rally behind our new leader. This is something that Mitt Romney did for Barack Obama 4 years ago, that John McCain did for Barack Obama 8 years ago. This is something that Al Gore did for George W. Bush in 2000, once the Supreme Court had settled the matter and effectively said that George Bush had won the election. This is a longstanding American tradition, and it is important institutionally in that it confers legitimacy on the new leader when you have that leader's opponent conceding. And we don't know how this will play out. And in fact, we don't even know that Trump will lose. But if he does lose and if he does refuse to concede, this would be a first and a quite unsettling first for the nation.
Hinting at that as rather dangerous ramifications, I mean, all through this process, from the primaries all the way up to the big race, you see a series of concessions and consolidations as people fall out of the race, come together with the eventual winner all the way up to the top. And this is how we as a society have always kind of stuck together, even if the particular candidate that we didn't care for ended up winning. Ultimately, Americans support that candidate.
There's no indication that whatever Donald Trump might say, that a majority of Americans would therefore view Hillary Clinton as an illegitimate president. However, we do know that Donald Trump has a core group of supporters, and it's not a small group by any means. And if millions upon millions of Americans believe Donald Trump and take him at his word that the election is stolen, what does that mean for governing the country? What sort of effects might we see on election day if their supporters go to polling places believing that there are forces at work to steal the election? What sort of conflicts might we see breaking out at polling locations across the country? Might there be some sort of unrest after the election? We just don't know. But this is something that those of us who look at the statements that are being made right now, it's certainly a possibility that we have to consider.
The voters decide one way or another. They're the ones who ultimately decide which way this thing goes. To say that 3 weeks out, that could be a possible stance of somebody who, in fact, is very far behind.
Well, that is, in fact, what the Democrats are saying. The vice presidential nominee, Tim Kaine, was on the various Sunday television shows saying, look, this is someone who thinks he's going to lose and is trying to make excuses beforehand and to point blame at everyone but himself.
VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman giving us great information each and every week and wonderful perspectives as this race continues. Thank you so much, Mike.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
Americans go to the polls on November the 8th. Right now, it's time for us to check out what people are talking about on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me here in the studio with what's dominating the web on the other side of the pond. Mm-hmm. Hi, G. What do you have for us?
Hi, Jim. So the first story has to do with the European Union on the whole, but more specifically about the United Kingdom. The UK is facing a nationwide Marmite shortage. Long story short, the country's largest supermarket, Tesco, stopped online sales of Marmite due to price increases thanks to Brexit. And Brexit, as you know, is a country's decision to leave the EU.
Well, I can see that being a huge problem there, especially mm-hmm. when people are a little bit hungry. Explain to our listeners what Marmite is.
Sure. It's probably an unfamiliar product to many people, unless you grew up in the UK or a former British colony like I did. It's a very common spread that people use on toast, but unlike jelly or chocolate hazelnut, it's thick and also pungent.
Well, how's that affecting social media?
People are using hashtag MarmiteGate to share their concerns, and of course, given that it's on the internet, jokes. Some people are tweeting, need to panic buy and resell on eBay. That's a business person right there. Mm-hmm. And others are saying they're disappointed the trending hashtag is not Marmageddon. Which do you think is more apt, Jim?
Well, I don't know. Marmite Gate, of course, that's more of an Americanized
I know,
term.
I like Marmageddon because it is a big deal.
Yeah, Marmageddon, well, yeah. If you're hungry, it's definitely a big deal.
Mm-hmm. I just want to reiterate that the Marmite shortage is trending on social media because it is really the first tangible effect of Brexit for many Brits.
Interesting. Well, what else is trending?
There is a relatively simple Google Pixel hack going around on social media that will turn your phone into more or less like the new Google handset. What it will do is add the Google Assistant feature if you can make two tweaks in a single configuration file. And Google Assistant is a feature like Apple iPhone Siri, which is like an assistant that lives on your phone and does things for you. But I say relatively simple because it does require a basic knowledge of coding.
Okay.
Jim, back to you.
Thanks so much for the wrap-up, G. As we have now hacked what's out there on social media, you can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE or drop into our own individual accounts if you like. I'm at VOA Stevenson, and G is at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia. The United Nations says 370,000 Afghans returned home from Pakistan. A typhoon hits the Philippines. China to send two astronauts into space. Pentagon reports failed missile launch by North Korea. A stampede at a Hindu festival kills 19 in northern India. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more at the voanews.com website. Also, via smartphone, you can use our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The death of Thai King Bhumibol, who reigned for 70 years, is causing concern in the kingdom and abroad as Thailand faces an uncertain future. There are both immediate and long-term questions about the monarchy. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Steve Herman reports that these questions are being felt as far away as Silver Spring, Maryland.
Grief, anxiety, and puzzlement are the dominant emotions enveloping Thais both home and abroad following the announcement that 88-year-old King Bhumibol Adunadet had died. It should have come as no shock. The monarch had been in poor health for years, and it was assumed that Thailand, under military rule since a coup 2.5 years ago, would race to name Crown Prince Vajiralongkorn as the next king. But that did not happen when the junta's hand-picked National Assembly hastily convened. Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, who as army chief seized government power in the 2014 coup, says the heir apparent is not ready.
He asked for a delay in proclaiming him king and for it to be postponed to an appropriate time so he can mourn his father with the rest of the nation.
Journalist Paul Handley, the author of an unauthorized biography of the late king, which is banned in Thailand, calls this surprising and possibly dangerous.
It's raised questions of whether there's some kind of negotiations going on. And what that could be, we don't know, but it's not a good sign.
The crown prince has not been the recipient of adulation comparable to his father. He has spent much of his time in Germany, gaining a reputation for a more ostentatious and controversial lifestyle. Thais revered King Bhumibol, by contrast, for frequently going to meet farmers and poor villagers, his sleeves rolled up, a camera strapped around his neck, and a two-way radio on his belt.
They know that his successor can't fill those boots. They know that Prince Vajiralongkorn has never put himself out on royal missions, on rural development projects like his father did.
For now, among Thai expatriates, there is no communal outpouring of grief. Monks we spoke with here at this temple say they are awaiting instruction from Bangkok via the embassy. After all, it's been 70 years since the last king of Thailand died, and no religious leader is alive from that time to explain the protocol. Steve Herman, VOA News, at Wat Thai, Silver Spring, Maryland.
And be sure to check out the video that goes with Steve's report at our website, voanews.com. Steve Herman, a longtime Southeast Asia bureau chief who was stationed in Bangkok, so he knows a lot about it. Amid fears of threats posed by protectionism, the BRICS countries have vowed to deepen economic engagement, tackle the global economic slowdown, and combat cross-border terrorism. The leaders of the five emerging economies of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa wrapped up a summit on Sunday in Goa in the western part of India. Underlining the need for the BRICS countries to find common solutions, China's President Xi Jinping warned through a translator.
Some countries are getting more inward-looking in their policies. Protectionism is rising, and the forces against globalization are posing an emerging risk.
The five countries that make up about half of the world's population and contribute to about 25% of global gross domestic product were once seen as a rising economic force. But most of the BRICS nations are now wrestling with a slowdown after a spell of torrid growth, raising questions about whether their economic clout is on the wane. Pointing out the five emerging economies contributed to 50% of global growth in the past decade, the Chinese leader asserted the stature of the bloc has been rising. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi called for doubling trade within the BRICS bloc in the next 5 years to $500 billion by dismantling trade barriers and improving infrastructure. Modi, who spearheaded a drive to put terrorism at the center stage of the summit, said the BRICS leaders had been unanimous in recognizing the need to combat terrorism, which poses a global threat.
We also agreed that those who nurture, shelter, support, and sponsor such forces of violence and terror are as much a threat to us as the terrorists themselves.
The Indian Foreign Ministry tweeted that he had told the BRICS leaders that tragically, the, quote, mothership of terrorism is a country in India's neighborhood. Modi's reference was to Pakistan, which New Delhi alleges sponsors and supports terror groups that wage militant attacks in India. His emphasis on the issue of terrorism at the BRICS summit is part of a diplomatic offensive that he's mounted to bring international attention to India's concerns. In what analysts said was a reference to Beijing, Modi said,
selective approaches to terrorists, individuals and organizations will not only be futile, but also counterproductive.
In a joint statement, the BRICS nations said that they will move quickly to establish a new credit ratings agency. The developing countries complain the existing credit agencies are biased against them, making borrowing more expensive. And they have already set up a development bank of their own as part of their efforts to reform the global financial architecture. In Shanghai, Matt Brown tells us the world number one men's tennis ranking is now in sight for Andy Murray of Britain, after he won the Shanghai Masters for a third time.
The world number two is the best player on the planet right now. Murray's beaten Spaniard Roberto Bautista Agut 7-6, 6-1 in an energy-sapping final played in hot, sticky conditions. The Scot running away with the second set after a tightly contested opener.
You know, in all of the matches, I was hitting the ball pretty clean. Obviously, I think we played four top 20 players or top 25 players this week. And yeah, played some really good tennis against all of them. It wasn't, you know, that easy to come in and play really well straight away because the conditions were very different to Beijing, but got off to a really good start against Johnson and kind of kept it up from there. It got better each match, I think.
Playing in his first Masters 1000 final, Bautista Agut saved three first set points, with Murray serving at 5-4. The Spaniard then led 6-5 before the Scot found another gear.
Not easy for me to handle all the emotions I had this week, and for me it was not easy to feel perfect on the court in the first final appearance in Masters 1000. But I think I gave everything on the court today as every week. But I think I could play better tennis today.
Murray's extended his winning streak to 10 matches without dropping a set in China, winning his sixth title of the year and closing in fast on world number one Novak Djokovic in the rankings. Matt Brown, VOA Sports, Shanghai.
And you'll find more on that tournament and a whole lot more on our podcast, VOA Game Room, which I happen to host. Look for it on our website at voanews.com. Be sure also to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. There are around 80,000 people living in the Zaatari refugee camp in Jordan, and for 1 month, that number included documentary filmmaker Chris Temple and fellow producer Zach Ingrassi. They set up a tent in the middle of the camp as the Americans meant to experience, along with the Syrian refugees there, how it feels to live in a diaspora. Their goal was to communicate their day-to-day interactions with the rest of the world. The result is a documentary called Salam Neighbor. VOA's Penelope Plou has more.
In District 5, yeah, it's going to be your temporary home. This was the first time that Chris Temple and his co-producer were visiting the Middle East.
So when we arrived in that camp, we were really nervous until the second we start setting up our tent, all these refugee families started pouring out of the tents next to us.
Chris Temple told VOA he made this film to dispel this prejudice.
The population that's bearing the biggest burden and fear around terrorist attacks, you know, are refugee populations, are Arab populations and Muslim populations in this region. This isn't, you know, a Muslim versus Christian attack. And imagine being a family inside of Syria right now, where you're stuck between Assad and a group like ISIS.
Salam Neighbor features a number of Syrians, mostly from middle-class families, who fled their country. One of them is 11-year-old Rauf, who suffers from PTSD from bombings near his house. Despite Zaatari's seeming safety, 11 kilometers from the war zone, bombings still rock the camp.
Well, what did Rauf do wrong? You know, he's a young 11-year-old boy, and in many ways, this refugee crisis, especially the Syrian refugee crisis, is one of women and children. I mean, 75% are women and children of the 4.8 million refugees.
Chris Temple hopes his documentary will help open hearts and minds about the millions of Syrian refugees stranded in countries such as Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and Greece.
I think that one of the biggest myths about refugees is that they're assumed to be burdens. You have doctors, you have lawyers. Ghassoun, one of the people in our film, was a nurse back in Syria. So they have so much they could productively contribute to their whatever new country they're going to.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. You know, there's a place on the internet where you can always find us. That's our website, voanews.com. You can also like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and be sure to follow our Twitter stream. It's at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, and our engineer is Daryl Smith. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for taking part of your day to spend it with us. Have a wonderful day ahead. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
October 16th is World Food Day, a day of action against hunger. The day commemorates the founding in 1945 of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO. On this day, people around the world come together to declare their commitment to eradicate hunger in our lifetime. Over the past decade or so, we have seen a great reduction of people living with hunger on a nearly daily basis. Back then, about 1 in 6 people went to bed hungry most nights. Now it's about 1 in every 9. Nonetheless, that still leaves some 795,000 chronically hungry people around the world. Of these, 60% are women. And this despite the fact that most small farmers living in the developing world are women. And when women go hungry, so all too often do children. About 161 million kids under the age of 5 are malnourished. This means that their brains won't develop normally, they may have difficulties learning, and their physical and cognitive growth is stunted. Lack of nutrition compromises not only their own successes in the future, but also the development of the communities, economies, and countries in which they live. In addition to those children who are chronically undernourished, almost 5 million children under the age of 5 die of malnutrition-related causes every year. The global community is working to eradicate hunger because it is the right thing to do. The first of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals called for halving the production of people suffering from hunger and facing extreme poverty. We have achieved that goal. As we transition to a sustainable development agenda for 2030, we have raised our ambitions and are striving to effectively end hunger and extreme poverty altogether. The United States aids this effort through its innovative Feed the Future initiative. We partner with country governments, many universities, multilateral and non-governmental organizations, transnational organizations like the UN, research communities, and the private sector to lift millions of vulnerable people out of hunger and poverty. On World Food Day, the United States reaffirms its commitment to the fight against poverty, hunger, and undernutrition.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.